start out by talking about a 100-watt light bulb. That's, I think, something which each of one of you knows. You can buy it in the market, and it is a bulb, and it is stamped 100 watt. Now, what does it mean? It means that if you screw it into the socket, still nothing happens. But if you switch on the switch, then it will draw 100 watts. Watts is a unit of power. And when it draws this power during time, then the product of watts of power times times gives you work. Now maybe this is too fast. I want to go back once more. We have a 100 watt bulb. I put this square out. If I multiply it by 10, that is, I buy not only one bulb, but I buy 10 bulbs. Then I have in my hand the power of 1,000 watts, 100 times 10, 1,000 watts, or we call that a kilowatt. Kilo means 1,000, comes from the Greek word kilios, which means 1,000. So we have 1,000 watts. Now if we switch these 10 100 watt bulbs on for 1 hour, then we have consumed energy. We have consumed energy, you see, or work. And we have to pay for it. We have just consumed 1 kilowatt hour. 1,000 watts or 1 kilowatt times 1 hour gives 1 kilowatt hour. And this 1 kilowatt hour may cost anywhere from 1 cent, 2 cents, 3, 4, 5 cents, depending on what part of the United States you are. Now here in the Northwest, where we have hydro power, that is water power, as the source of our energy, the electricity is very inexpensive. There's only one part in the whole United States which is less expensive, that's Chattanooga in Tennessee, where they also have water power. But otherwise, we are the, as a region, we are the lowest priced regions in the whole United States, which is very nice. So we have then 1,000 watt or 1 kilowatt times 1 hour. Now, we can produce the same thing if we take just 100 watt bulb and burn it for 10 hours. Is this clear? You see, 100 watt times 10 hours gives 1,000 watt hours or 1 kilowatt hour. So we get the have to pay exactly the same amount, 2 cents or whatever it is, if you burn 100 watt bulb for 10 hours as if you take 10 100 watt bulbs for 1 hour. You see, kilowatt hour is the product of the kilowatts and the times and the hours. So the kilowatts, or the watts, is power. And the product, kilowatt times time, is called work. You pay for work. Now we have exact analogy with the car. If the car stands in the garage and your engine may have 100 horsepower, you do not use a drop of gasoline because this is the potential work which the car can give. The same if you have your bulb but you don't switch it on. Well, of course, you don't pay any electricity. But if you start your car, you keep it running, then you use gasoline. The moment you run it, then you get work. As long as the car sits in the garage, the engine has a certain power, namely so and so many horsepower, 100 horsepower. I am very insistent that these terms be clearly understood, because in the newspaper, I would say 9 times out of 10, these basic concepts are confused. The people speak of kilowatt hours if they mean kilowatt, and they speak of the other way around too, which always annoys me. So the power is expressed in kilowatt. Now if we have an automobile, it has 100 horsepower. Horsepower is pretty much, is definitely related to kilowatt. There's a relation, 746 watts are 1 horsepower, which is rather unimportant. So very roughly, if you have a 100 horsepower engine, this would be the same as if you would have a 74, 75 horsepower, a kilowatt engine. You see, both are power. Now, if I speak about power plants, I speak of plants which generate power. Whether this power is being used, whether there is work, that's another question, you see. Now, I want to get this concept completely straight. If you have a river like the Columbia and you have a dam across, and in the dam are a number of generators put in which produce electric power, they may not produce power because the power is not necessary, but the plant has a certain power rating, that is, the machines are designed for this power. The same I would say if you have a 10 or 100 horsepower automobile and you cruise at a very low speed on a perfectly smooth city street, then you don't use your 100 horsepower. But the potential of your engine is 100 horsepower so that you can race uphill, you see. So the same with a power plant. The power plant has a certain power rating, or as we say, nameplate rating. Each of the units has a certain nameplate rating, which indicates how much power it can produce, but not it must produce. How much is produced depends on how much the customers draw out, how much the customers consume. Now, I hope I made that clear. Now, if we speak of these power plants, we have to go to larger units. I already said that 1,000 watts are called a kilowatt, so we get rid of three zeros, 1 kilowatt. That's the unit which is quite familiar to you. Now, if we have 1,000 kilowatts, we call that 1 megawatt. Mega stands for a million. So 1 megawatt are 1,000 kilowatts, and a kilowatt is 1,000 watts, so a megawatt is 1,000,000 watts. You see, I said here, 1 megawatt is 1,000 kilowatts. And then we have one more higher unit. We can go one step further, and we say 1,000 megawatts are 1 gigawatt. This is the quantity which I like very much, because you get rid of innumerable zeros, but it is not very much used yet in this country. In Europe, it is quite a bit used. So now, the last thing I just want to tell you in advance, that here all the power produced in the generator in the Pacific Northwest is 22 gigawatts, or 22,000 megawatts, or 22 million kilowatts. Yeah, I wrote this in the slide. Or 22 billion watts. We don't have to go into watts. So let's say 22 million kilowatts. Now, in this area are very roughly 10 million people. That is 3 million people in Washington, 2 million people in Oregon. And just for good measure, we have a few more people in Montana and in Idaho. There are not very many in Idaho. In all Idaho are only 800,000 people, less than a million. But just to be very generous, say 10 million. So if we divide the 22 million kilowatts by 10 million people, then we find that each person has at its disposal 2.2 kilowatts. That is, each person could, in theory, burn 22 100-watt bulbs. And that's a big slug of energy, you see. Each person here in the Northwest has so much energy at his disposal, that he can burn 22 100-watt bulbs. Now, of course, all the energy is not used for lighting, as you know very well. A very large amount goes into heating here in the Pacific Northwest. Practically everybody has electric ranges here, electric warm water heaters. Many people have electric house heating. We have 6,000 houses in Spokane which are completely electrically heated. I have an additional heater in my room, otherwise I have oil heat. Even oil heat uses electricity to run the pump and the blower. So, in addition to the what we call residential load, of course, there is a very large industrial load. I talked yesterday about the aluminum plant, and the aluminum plant takes an enormous chunk of this energy to produce aluminum. That's the electrochemical industry. And then, of course, we have other industries, innumerable industries, all over the area, which have motors for any type of industrial work, which I don't have to explain what this is for anything. So this is where this energy is being used. Now I want to show you the area here, the Pacific Northwest area, and I want to show you what is called the basin. The basin is the area of the Columbia River plus all its tributaries. That is all the rivers which go into the Columbia. The Columbia, of course, goes into the ocean, into the Pacific, but there are a number of rivers, some of them very substantial, which also have power plants. Now first, an idea of the whole range. Here is the Pacific. This is Vancouver Island. Here is the Olympic Peninsula. And yellow are the cities. This is Vancouver, D.C. Here's the Fraser River, which is outside of our area. Here is Everett, and here's Seattle on the Sound. And here is the Columbia coming, and here's Portland, which is Portland and Vancouver. Vancouver, Washington. You see that Portland is Vancouver, Washington. And now here is the Natchez. This little thing here is our Lake Chelan, and this star is the only star that's holding, yeah? Okay. The Columbia originates in Canada,
in British Columbia, near the Continental Divide. That's this very large rib of mountains, which, as the name implies, is a divide of the waters. Everything which flows off the mountains goes to the west and goes to the Columbia system and eventually into the Pacific. Everything which goes on the east side down goes eventually into the Mississippi and goes into the Gulf. You see, so that's the big divide which goes here right through the country. It comes here down to Canada. On the east side is Alberta, on the west side is British Columbia. When we come into the United States, Montana is partly to the west, partly to the east of the divide, so the mountains go right through Montana. And then here goes on, here's Wyoming, here's Yellowstone Park, you see. And then our area, the area about which I talk, that is the Columbia Basin, goes here from the from this part in British Columbia all the way down to a little bit of Utah, a little bit here of Wyoming, a little bit of Nevada, which very few people know, and then it goes here, the major part of Oregon, all of Idaho, and all of Washington. This is an enormous area, but it does not go to the ocean, because here we have the Cascades. These are the Cascades here, quite a mighty range, because you just have to look out of the window. And what runs up on the west side of the Cascades goes directly into the ocean, directly here into Puget Sound, and into the ocean, and does not go into Columbia. So the limits of the Columbia Basin, and that's what I'm talking about, is this limit here. You see here it goes on top of the Cascades. Here it goes into Canada, around here on the divide, and then it ambles here to Yellowstone and here this line. And here, of course, these two things come together because here the Columbia empties into the ocean. Here's Australia. Now, we want to trace the course of the Columbia. It starts here and goes northwest. Then it turns around, goes straight south, enters into the United States here, makes some curlicues, here's Wenatchee, makes some more curlicues, here we are at Pasco Kennebec, Richland, and here the Snake comes in. The Snake River, the major tributary, very important, large river, comes here out of Yellowstone Park, goes here through the southern part of Idaho, that's all desert. Here it forms the border between Idaho and Oregon. Now you have a lesson in geography instead of electricity. So here it goes, forms the border between Oregon and Idaho. Here's Hell's Canyon. Yes, it's very, very deep gorge, deeper than Grand Canyon, and wilder, but much narrower. And then here it comes out, here's Lewiston. Here are a number of power plants, which I will describe in a moment. And then it empties here at Pasco Kennebec into the Columbia. And the Columbia then goes here pretty much west, breaks through the Cascades, very gorgeous gorge, beautiful to drive here to see it. And then it goes right here at Portland. And then there's still another 100 miles, Longview and Astoria, and finally it empties into the Pacific. So far for the Columbia. Now, the other tributaries, there's the here's the Clearwater and with its various forks, and here's the Spokane River, and here's the Pendoray River, and here's the Kootenay River, which starts quite close to the starting point of the Columbia. As a matter of fact, within a mile. But the Kootenay goes south, goes into the United States, into Montana, then turns west, goes to Idaho, and then leaves the United States again, goes into Canada, back into British Columbia, and then empties in the Columbia, still in British Columbia. That's called Kootenay, which is also a tributary, you see, an important tributary. We have other tributaries on the west side, which I didn't draw, like the Wenatchee River, but they are not very important, they don't produce power. They are used for irrigation, you see. Okay, now, it was during the Depression that Roosevelt, FDR, who was then president, decided it would be a good idea to put men to work and at the same time to build a hydroelectric plant in this area. This area was still completely undeveloped then, compared to what it is now. It's still pretty empty, as you know. Before that, there was a private group which built the first plant, Rock Island, in 1933, which is right here, quite close to the Wenatchee. That's the oldest plant on the Columbia. which is a very mighty river. But a few years later, in 1938, Bonneville was built,
named after an early pioneer, I found it out.
Oh, it's one of his name comes from. And this is the first federal plant, the first plant built with federal money, which was built during the midst of the Depression. It was in 1929, was crashed in 1938.
I was just in this country in 2 years, and I know people were gradually recovering, but they were very loath to hire anybody, including me, you see.
So it was, the Depression still had its aftermath, and its, what shall I say, its convulsions 10 years later. So at that time, Bonneville was started. It was built here a little bit east of Portland. And Grand Coulee was started in 1941, which is here, GC. I underlined it because that's the largest plant.
When Grand Coulee was built, of course, there was tremendous criticism. What do you do with electric energy? You want to feed it to the gophers? There was absolutely nobody around, you see. But then the war had broken out in Europe, and then, lo and behold, a little bit later, Pearl Harbor occurred, and it was just wonderful and providential almost that this dam had been started to be built, because this energy was used at once. As soon as a generator got into operation, its energy was used for producing aluminum in Spokane. Here is Spokane, you see, so energy was brought over here. And there were lines built, very importantly, to Seattle and then to Hartford, to the atomic plants there, a little bit later. You see, this came a little bit later. So these were the initial plants. And there was a general scheme which was already prepared as early as 1928 by the Corps of Engineers of the Army. This was the so-called 308 report by Major John S. Butler, today of quite some historical interest, which visualized in a completely prophetic and almost utopian way a complete harnessing and a complete development of this mighty, untamed river on which the Indians still did their salmon fishing, and at a time when nobody even thought of harnessing it. You see, technology in 1928 was a far cry from what it is now. So even at that early time, there were quite specific proposals how many plants could be built and how could the whole river be developed, not only to produce electricity, but at the same time, two other very, very important things should be done. The river should be made navigable all year round. That is, in connection with these dams would be locks, so that ships could go upstream and downstream. And in addition to that, irrigation schemes were developed to irrigate the desert and to transform the desert land into a fertile area. Very visionary plans, derided, money didn't come forth, and so on and so on. But eventually, these things finally got underway, and it was then that the Bonneville Power Administration, which we call BPA, was created by an act of Congress, and this BPA agency, federal agency, puts out reports every year, of course, of which I get one because I'm on their mailing list, that I know these people, and this shows now what progress has occurred and what will occur, and they are forecasts for the next 10 years, and they have a detailed list of all the power plants and the nameplate ratings of each plant, and in the back they gave a list of those people who are on the advisory committee of the various areas and cities, and here we have our friend Mr. Logan, or what was his name? From Tacoma. It's right here. Well, anyway, so the Bonneville Power Administration was charged by act of Congress to be the marketing agency, to market the electricity which is produced in this area and to distribute it. The plants themselves were built by various agencies, partly by the Corps of Engineers, because they were interested in harnessing the river and preventing floods. This is historically their field, On the Mississippi, they have built the levees on the lower Mississippi to prevent floods and inundations, you see. So the Corps of Engineers has a legitimate reason to be in this area, and they were the people, the Corps of Engineers, their engineers designed a number of important plants along the Columbia and tributaries. Another agency of the federal government, somewhat in competition, I would say, is the Bureau of Reclamation. Bureau of Reclamation, which is part of the Department of the Interior, whose job it is to reclaim lands, that is to irrigate dry lands and to prevent other lands from being flooded. So they also built a number of plants, but both of these agencies channeled the energy which they produced into the transmission system of the Bonneville Power Administration. The Bonneville Power Administration has blanketed the whole area with a transmission system. So irrespective of where the energy is produced, or where it is used, it goes first through the system, and this is now distributed on an equitable basis, that is, on the basis of greatest economy for the whole region. Now this is very interesting and totally different from the East. In the East, there were a number of independent, mostly private, utilities, and they served their own areas, and while they eventually interconnected, they were not conceived as one overall unit. Because the Northwest is conceived on this regional basis, the dangers of a blackout and of the troubles which had beset the East are definitely much less. Now, in addition to these federal plants, there are also plants which are owned and operated by PUDs. PUDs is public utility districts, which is more or less synonymous with county. So the PUD of Chelan, you see, is something, and the PUD of Grant County, and so on. Now, these counties have, in many cases, very small number of people, and consequently, very small amount of monies. They could not build such huge power plants, each plant costing more than $100 million. So what they do is this. They float bonds, get in a consulting engineering company to build and supervise the building of such power plant, but it belongs to the PUD. And the energy which is produced by the PUD goes then into the grid, into the overall transmission system, and is maybe sold to the city of Seattle or to the city of Portland. And in this way, they are able to retire their revenue bonds and make some money. So even if a county has maybe 100,000 people, they can produce energy which is sufficient to satisfy 1 million people. And these 90% energy which they do not use in their own county is then transmitted to the areas where it is being used. But in this region, it is possible to develop hydroelectric sites in sparsely populated areas as we have them here. For instance, here is Rock Island, which is developed by Chelan County, and there are not very many people here. The only town of any size is Wenatchee, and adjacent to that is the aluminum plant of Alcoa, but the Rock Island and pre-profits, they produce much more energy than this area needs. So this goes into the grid and is then distributed all over the system. Now, I want to give you the name of a few of these plants because this may be of some interest. On the Columbia, here is Grand Coulee, which is the largest plant in the whole region. It is 2 gigawatts, that is 2,000 megawatts or 2 million kilowatt power at the moment. But the third powerhouse, you may have heard, that is under construction. And when the third powerhouse will be completed, there will be an addition of 3.6 gigawatts or 3.6 million kilowatts. So then the combined power output will be 5.6 gigawatt, for 5,600,000 kilowatt, which will make it the largest hydro plant of the world. When Grand Coulee was built, it was the largest plant. In the meantime, there are several larger plants in Siberia, where they also have large hydroelectric developments and Baikal Sea.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
How do they determine, particular gorge before you even built any dams or anything? How do you determine
Oh, this cannot be done in a day or not in a year, and not even in 10 years, I would say. There are very, very long-range surveys of the stream flow. And that's also, of course, part of the federal agencies, in this case, probably in cooperation with the Canadian agencies. You find out what is the average stream flow and what are the maximum flood which have ever occurred, you see, and also what are the minimum stream flows. Now, that's the first thing. Then the next thing is to determine a site, which depends, of course, on the geology. You have to have a perfect bedrock, which is sufficiently strong to support these enormous dams without sagging and cracking and so on. So there's a very large work which has to be done before. And these dams are, while they are, many of them, have the combined function of producing electric power and preventing flood and irrigation, you see, it is so that in extreme years, maybe once every 100 years or one every 80 years, there may be more water than could be possibly stored. So there's always, for economic reasons, a danger that some damage may occur in a totally unusual year. You cannot provide such dams, you cannot possibly do it so that you are protecting people for all contingencies, you see. But you have a vast improvement because there are areas, for instance, on the Lower Kootenay, which were almost year after year after year inundated when the snow melted and the fields were put underwater, and so when the water then receded, there's danger of malaria and all these things. This is eliminated. But the government or whoever has jurisdiction cannot guarantee that in no future time this may not recur once every 100 years or so. This is answer your question.
Since Grand Coulee was originally built, have they come up with more efficient generators that would produce more
Yes.
power than originally?
Yes, I would say yes, but the gain is not very spectacular. The generators which are in Grand Coulee are quite efficient. So this is not something which would show a dramatic change. What is changed is the size of the unit. The old units which are at Grand Coulee, each unit has approximately 100,000 horsepower. You see, 110,000 horsepower. So they're 18 units. Figure it out, you have to do some calculation. 2.2 gigawatts, that is 2,200,000 kilowatt, and then you have the relation of horsepower and kilowatt. And if you figure it out, you have 18 units, 9 in one powerhouse, 9 in the other powerhouse. Grand Coulee is an enormous dam. You may have seen it, or you have seen pictures across the valley, across the Coulee. And there are two powerhouses at the two sides of the dam, and each has 9 units. Now the third powerhouse will have 6 units, and each has 600,000 horsepower. So you can nowadays build much larger units, though these units cannot be transported by railroads. They have to be brought in parts and will then be assembled on the site. But they are more efficient. These enormous large units, they are largest units of the world when they are being built. They have not been built yet, have not even been started. They will be more efficient, but not spectacularly more efficient, you see.
I could answer that a little on Grand Coulee, because I was in on part of it. These units are 108,000 kilowatts, and during the war they carried 120,000 all through, and sometimes 130,000. They've all been rewound. When they were built, the insulation was what we call Class B, and they had a lot of trouble with corrosion. On the ends of the turns, you can see them glow at night. They've improved the insulation, and they rewound them, and they can carry 130,000 now. But when the water works out, the steel in the new generators have been improved a lot. So that's the most, but you can't do much about that. They have hypercell steel today, which doesn't have what we call hysteresis, or the losses when they change from.
But I'm glad that you say that. But you see, if the efficiency of these machines was maybe, I guess, 95%, the new machines may have 98%. You see, it's in this order. So don't think that the old machines were inefficient.
No.
All right.
I just thought of
yeah.
new developments.
But they are larger. They are considerably larger. Mm-hmm. And each machine is not 6 times more expensive than the old one, but maybe 3 times more, 4 times.
How about transmission line system, say, DC transmission versus AC transmission.
Oh, I come to that.
I found change in the machines were like at Niagara Falls. They were the first 25 cycle, and they have changed all those old machines. They were put in about 1902 and 1903, and there's been, but these have been put in 1941. There hasn't been too much change.
Wasn't it true that there was such a urgent need to put machines at Grand Coulee that they took machines which were originally designed for Shasta and installed them there, because to build these large machines is a matter of years. So as soon as these machines were available at General Electric or Westinghouse, they were stuck here into Bonneville, into Grand Coulee, and after the war, finally, they were returned, many years after the war, they were returned to their original destination. Finally, I found your name here, Mr. Thorne, as one of the advisors in the Bonneville Regional Advisory Committee Seattle area. So we have the expert right here, you see. Now, this Grand Coulee is a very high dam, and at that place the river is not navigable anymore. The river is navigable now all the way up here to this area, and it may eventually become navigable up to Wenatchee. This is provided for. But it is not navigable here up to Grand Coulee, and certainly not above Grand Coulee. So there's a high dam, and there's a large lake called Lake Roosevelt, which is over 100 miles long, which goes from here right to the Canadian border. And this was done in the 30s or 40s because one respected the rights, the territorial rights of the neighboring country, and it was considered a somewhat touchy affair to inundate territory in a neighboring, if very friendly, country. Now these considerations have been overcome happily, and Libby Dam, which is now under construction on the Kootenay, will, when it is finished, back off water quite a bit into Canada. This has been agreed, and of course these people are indemnified, and the cities have been, will be relocated. So this limitation which existed when Bonneville was built does not hold anymore. Now, as I said, there's this high dam, and this dam produces 2.2 million kilowatt, and when the third powerhouse will be finished, there will be another 3.6 gigawatt. But in addition to that, this plant, in addition to producing this vast amount of electricity, has another function. It pumps. It pumps water for irrigation. You see, the Columbia itself has dug itself a deep gorge during many, many millions of years, and flies, of course, at the bottom of this gorge, of this Coulee. And the surrounding countryside is fairly level, but maybe 200, 250 feet higher. And what has been done is this. There is a large pumping plant, underground pumping plant, which you can visit. Anybody can go there, push the button, goes down 6 or 8 floors with an elevator, and then he comes on a balcony, or from the balcony he sees a large, impressive plant all underground. And these plants are pumping motors. Underneath of each motor is a large pump. And about one third of the energy produced at Grand Coulee is used right away at Grand Coulee itself, just a few hundred feet away, in this pumping plant. And a very sizable amount of water, I don't know how many million cubic feet per second, I can check that, and so no interest, are being lifted from the level of the Lake Roosevelt, behind the dam, several hundred feet until it comes to an equalizing reservoir, which is now called Banks Lake, after one of the men who had their fingers in it. And from this lake, it is distributed by gravity, without further pumping, over the countryside of central Washington. And about 500,000 acres here, this area here, about 500,000 acres have been brought under cultivation, and eventually 1 million acres will be irrigated from Grand Coulee. Now, in addition to that, there's quite recently a tendency for the farmers to drill their own deep wells and get their own water out of the ground, which is all right for them, but may disturb the ecology because it might lower the water table, so these problems are still not completely resolved. But at any rate, the water which has been or is being pumped up out of Grand Coulee and then distributed has transformed the desert into into a blooming garden. It was absolutely fantastic. When we came to the Northwest in 1952, my wife and I, and we traveled around, there was a post in the middle of nowhere, and it says, County Seat of Ephrata, and we both laughed our heads off, because there was just this post, you see? And now the city stands there and serves the whole area around it, which is covered with corn, sugar beets, all kinds of stuff, including even mint. So when mint is being harvested, the whole area smells for miles of this mint, which is being used for chiclets and for therapeutic purpose and so on. It is absolutely amazing. And one of the first pictures I took when I came out was the striking difference between an area which was irrigated, which was green and fertilized, and all the nice forests, and just adjacent to that, like with a knife, the desert with its sagebrush and nothing else. I had a photo, half of it is grayish desert, and the other half of it is dark green irrigated area. Absolutely striking. So that's a very important function of this Columbia Basin overall scheme. So now we go from Grand Coulee downstream, and here we come to Chief Joseph, very large power plant. If anybody goes back from here, from Chelan to Spokane, I would suggest, if he's interested, take this route, because Chief Joseph is, being a federal plant, open at any time, day or night, to inspection. Anybody can go in, visitors are always welcome. In Grand Coulee, there is not much to be done because the third powerhouse is under construction. You cannot go across the dam, you cannot go to the powerhouse, so that's somewhat frustrating. But the Chief Joseph, you can look at it, you go right down where the generators are, where the big shafts are, you can see them right in front of you, and that's quite educational. Then here we have Wells, which is a private, that is a power plant of a PUD. Here we have Three Strapes, we have Rock Island, here we have Wanapum, and here we come to the three city areas where there's Pasco, Kennedy, and Richland, you see, and it indicates the cities, and then we come in. Here the snake comes into the Columbia. Here we have McNary, very large plant. Here we have John Day, a quite recent plant. Here we have the Dalles, all large plants. And here we have Bolivar. Then they go into the ocean. Now on the snake, we have a number of plants. This is Ice Harbor, which is finished. We have Lower Monumental, which is under construction. Little Goose, which is under construction. And Lower Granite, which is under construction. I visited them all. I have fun to visit power plants. So these are in various stages of construction, but will be finished fairly soon. So they all produce energy. Then, of course, we have other plants here in the middle snake. This is Hell's Canyon. I was there when it was opened. It was open house. It's very nice to roam around. And that's Oxford Brownlee. And then there are a number of quite small plants here on the upper Snake River, but there are a number of lakes which are used for irrigation, because in southern Idaho, irrigation was developed quite early. That's all desert land, and when it is irrigated, it's just as fertile as the central Columbia Basin area. Now, we have other plants here. This is the Pendorei, and here we have Boundary, which is a plant which was built by the city of Seattle. But instead of getting the energy from here all the way to Seattle, the energy is just stuck into the system, into the basic system, and Seattle draws out energy where it needs. It is not so that this energy is, as we call it, wheeled all the way 300 miles across, you see? This energy is put into the system. It is maybe used in the meat, the plant, and Spokane and so on, but all the energy which is produced is then brought to Seattle. Now Seattle itself, city of Seattle, has its own power plants, quite substantial plants, which are fed by rivers going on the west side of the Cascade. So I did not draw that in because I was chiefly concerned with the basin. But again, if you go to Seattle and you have time for a day, you can make arrangements with Seattle City Lights, which is the name of the utility, and you go then to this place there in the Spellum, and you have a full one-day trip to these various power plants, which is exceedingly interesting and very nice. You get there first at 11:30, and you have an information discussion, same way as I give it now. Then you sit down to a very wonderful meal with ham and as much as you can eat and ice cream. And then there are some buses waiting, and you are brought to three power plants, including a lift which goes on the side of the mountain up from one level to the northern. Then you go into a motorboat, you drive over one lake, very beautiful, all complete wild scenery on the west side of the Cascades, you see? That's here, on this side. And then you come to another power plant, to Ross, and it is very worthwhile. With snow-covered mountains around, I can recommend to do that. But you have to make reservations long in advance. So, here are again plants which are privately owned. This is Pelton and Brown Butte on the, and here is the, what is the name of this river which goes to Portland, which has caused continuous flooding. This, what's the name of this river?
Willamette.
Willamette, sure. Yeah. There are a number of side rivers going into Willamette, and here are a number of plants which now have brought the Willamette River pretty much under control. So Willamette has caused many destructive floods year after year, but this has been now brought under control by the building of these plants here on the west side of the Cascades, you see, which is still within the basin range because the Willamette flows into the Columbia. All right, I couldn't draw all these plants, and of course they vary in size. These are very large plants because that's an enormous river. Now, the next point is this. Despite of all these plants, the amount of water carried by the Columbia varies during the course of a year. It varies quite a bit. In winter time, of course, when there's snow and ice, there's rather little water which comes down, and in the time of the melting snow in May, June, there is an enormous amount. So this situation has been very substantially improved by the signing of a contract with Canada a few years ago. Canada agreed to build 3 dams on its territory which will store water. One will eventually produce energy too, and which then will hold water in the time of the melting snow and release this water when it is needed. These plants are Mica, right here when the Columbia turns around. They are Duncan, which is a tributary which goes into the Scutini Lake, and Arrow, which is a comparatively low dam which builds up a long lake behind it, which is used again to bring water into the Columbia. Now, when these, Mica is still under construction, Arrow and Duncan are finished. When this water is released, you will realize that it goes through a whole series of power plants, and in each, then this precious water produces energy. It goes through Grand Coulee and through Chief Joseph and through Wells and Priest Prophets and the Rock Island and so on and so on. So this water, which is stored here, is extremely precious, because it will give considerable more energy and more assured energy. With the moment this contract was signed, it was possible to build additional units in these various power plants. These power plants were designed with this objective in mind, but these engines had, these units had not been installed, and they are by a long shot not yet installed, because there's a progressive development, a planned progressive development. Whenever there is more energy needed, and curiously enough, though this state does, or the neighboring states, do not grow very much in population, there's a continuous increase in the power demand. There's more industry, people heat more electrically, and so on. So for some reason, it is not gophers who don't need electricity. There must be people in this area. And I said that maybe 10 million eventually. Now they are probably still considerably less, maybe 8, I don't know. Which use electricity more and more. Now I, Ludwig Roman, have increased my power supply too, but not in a spectacular way. I have more gadgets, yes. Obviously, there is, strangely enough, when there is cheap, abundant electricity available, there's more and more and more being used. You see supermarkets get into use, more supermarkets are open, they all have their refrigerators, they have vast electric light, all bright like daylight, and they have air conditioning, which uses quite a bit of energy. So of course there are continuous increases in electricity, which is fine. So to keep step with these increases, there will be new units gradually installed in the existing plants. For instance, all these plants here will be built only for half their capacity initially. Aizawa, we will have four machines, four sets, and they had two running. And this is not even, this is as one running. These are still under construction. But you see, the dam is built, and the power so built that it can have an ultimate capacity. An ultimate capacity which depends on the amount of water which is available. Here you had this very fine thing that after the Canadian agreed to build these dams and to bring this energy into the United States, this could be done. Now this were long, protracted, delicate negotiations with the Canadian government. It was not only a Canadian government, it were two Canadian governments. The province, British Columbia, was pretty much agreed to do that. And then the federal government in Ottawa stepped in and said, no, nothing doing, you cannot squander our natural resources. We need this water, if not now, we may need it in 50 years or so. We will not sell it. So for that reason, these negotiations were protracted and delicate. The situation now is as follows. It was agreed that Canada can keep the excess electricity which is produced in the United States by virtue of this added water coming from these three dams, these three projects. So Canada can get all the electricity which is now additionally produced by their generosity. But Canada has at the moment no use for it. So Canada sells it back to the United States. Now this is of course nothing but a bookkeeping trick. The energy actually is produced in the United States and consumed in the United States. But Canada is involved because they get the credit for that. You see, Canada says, this your energy because you got it with your water, and then Canada said, fine, we don't need it, we sell it to you. See, so on this basis, this business is run. Now, in addition to this hydro, that is this water power, we have one plant thus far, one and only one plant which produces atomic power. I should have indicated that, and that's Hanford, which is right here, you see. This is a reactor which has a dual purpose of producing plutonium, which is fissionable material, and electricity. So if it doesn't produce plutonium, it is used to produce electricity in quite a nice amount, 600 megawatt, I think. But this reactor is sometimes in operation and sometimes not in operation. And while it is a very valuable part of the overall system, it is not absolutely reliable in that respect. So we have most the hydropower, but we have this one atomic power. We have also some very negligible, I think you will agree that, negligible amount of steam power, which was historically built in the cities like in Seattle, you have a small power, and if there is for some reason a very great dearth and drought and dryness, you see, then the steam plant can get into operation, which is expensive and messy and smoky and so on, and they don't contribute to any extent in the overall picture. But now we have the interconnection. That is, there are four lines which go from here down to California. The two lines are built for alternating current, a third line has been built for direct current, and the fourth line for direct current has not yet been built. These lines go to San Francisco and Los Angeles and eventually connect even farther east with the Colorado power of the hydro projects which are there in Arizona. So we have then, even now, an interchange between power of the Northwest, which is 98% water power and maybe 1%, 1.5% atomic power and tiny little bit steam power, and the power produced in California and Arizona. In Arizona, there's a little bit water power, you see, from the dams there of the Colorado River. But mostly it is steam power produced by natural gas and oil. You see, in the Los Angeles area, we have the oil and we have natural gas, so there are large plants there. So this interconnection proves very valuable because it brings excess water power down to the large cities, SF and LA, when it is necessary, and vice versa, when we are in a pinch during the time of the winter, when everybody heats like mad, but the snow doesn't melt, you see, we can get energy from the balmy southwest produced by steam, by natural gas or by oil, and this is then brought up to the northwest. So we had in last winter, last December, we had a cold snap, as the British say, a cold snap here, and we got a sizable amount of power from California wheeled up to us through this intertidal. That's quite a new technological development, and this DC business, direct current business, is the first large scale direct current transmission in the world. There are quite a few direct current transmissions in other parts of the world, mostly where you need undersea connections, that is submarine connections. You have, for instance, a connection between the North Island of New Zealand and the South Island of New Zealand. This is an underground submarine cable, and there you can transmit and can only transmit DC. You cannot transmit alternating current for technological reasons. And you have transmissions between the mainland of Sweden and an island in the Baltic. This was historically the first. You have a connection between England and France, which was more or less experimental and had all kinds of troubles because fishing boats tore up the cables first, and there were some other troubles, but I think it is running all right, though this does not amount to very much. The amount transmitted through these submarine transmissions between England and France is very small. It was to gain experimental data and experience. And you have some others. You have one between Sardinia and the mainland of Italy. But here in the United States now we have for the first time an overhead, a very long overhead direct current transmission, which is still in the state of construction. It has not been in operation yet, and it's being built. The line, one of the two lines, as I said, is finished. The second line has not even been started to be built, and the converter stations at the two ends are still being built. Well, I think that covers it. 10 o'clock. Now, any questions? I'll show you a few pictures here.
I have a question on this Columbia Basin.
This is John Day, which is the latest of these large hydroelectric projects on the Columbia. And like all of these projects, it has the following part. It has a lock, navigation lock. Then there's the spillway over which the excess water can go over in time of melting snow. And then there's a powerhouse, and then there's a fish ladder. I should mention this with a few words. There's commercial fishing, of course, on the coast, and the salmon goes upstream to to spawn. And if you have power plants which prevent the salmon from going upstream, the whole commercial fishing salmon industry is ruined. And for that reason, the commercial fishing interests have always been very, very eager and anxious to see that every provision is made for the salmon to migrate upstream. And there are fish ladders over which through which the fishes can negotiate these the projects. They can go against the current from the lower elevation to the upper elevation. And for instance, in McNeil, you have a counting station in which a girl sits there and in front of a window, and you see the fish going past upstream, and each time a fish goes, she pushes the button depending on the type of fish, and she does it maybe for half an hour. She does it completely automatically, and then all these are tallied, and then she lets down a heavy gate so no fish can migrate for 10 minutes, during which she goes upstairs with an elevator, smokes a cigarette, gets relaxation. Then she goes down, the gate is lifted, the fish can migrate again, she starts pushing. So this is being done, and every month is published so and so many thousand steelheads and so many thousands this and this and this will have migrated upstream. Now there's plenty of money spent in these fish ladders. Before they even built, there was still much more money spent for research to find out whether the salmon actually will go upstream. And there are special jets which attract the fish to the lower end of the fish ladder, that they don't go into the turbines, but they go to the fish ladder and so on. Quite interesting. And when you are here at Rocky Reach, when you go to Wenatchee, that is downstream, you can look in Rocky Reach and there's such a fish ladder, and there's a window and you can see the fish migrating there.
Yeah,
Okay, now comes your question.
This irrigation, vast irrigation area of Columbia Basin, some people claim that the weather has changed and they start to irrigate this vast area from...
I think that's true. And I think that's all for the better, because we get some moisture and we have a little bit more precipitation.
Yeah,
before that, it was a total desert area. And if you irrigate large areas and you have evaporation, of course, this evaporated moisture somewhere has to come down, which means rain.
I didn't know. I haven't seen
it. I think it's true, but it is not any dramatic change, no.
How far can you send current?
Economically. Well, this question, the answer varies with expanding technology. I would say in the 1920s, when I got into this picture, see how old I am, it was maybe 30, 40 miles, and then it was 50 miles and 100 miles. And when these dams were built here in the 30s, you could send 300 miles, that is from the eastern part of the state to the western part of the state. Now, in the year 1969, 70, 72, with this intertie getting into operation, you send it all the way from here down to LA. You know, this is what, 1,200 miles or so. In an economic way, you have certain losses on the in so doing, but these losses are very well kept within economic limits, you see. That's where the computers come in, you see. You can make conductors as large as you can possibly make them, and enormously heavy towers, you see, and then you save on your losses. This would be quite uneconomical. You spend all the money for an enormously thick line and very sturdy. This would be very uneconomical. And you can do the other extreme. You can build a very spidery tower, very thin conductors. You would save plenty of money in building the line, but you would have prohibitively high losses. Would be equally uneconomical. So between these two extremes, you find a minimum where you have tolerable losses with tolerable investment for your line. See, that's a typical engineering project. Very complex, because many, many factors enter it. The soil, the foundation, and the insulators, and the spans, and the right of way, and everything else. Now, these are transmission engineers' problems. Many of my colleagues work in this field to figure that out. It is not yet possible to transmit energy economically, say, from the western part of the United States to the eastern part of the United States. We are now, at this age, at this time, in a state where we have regional development. You see, there are four or five states involved. And they are connected to other states. You see, it goes down to California, to Arizona, Nevada, you see. But this is just the very beginning. You have similar regional developments in the East. You see, you have Pennsylvania, Maryland, New York, you see. New York is connected with Ontario, you see. But there is no connection across the country yet. It may come 10 years, 20 years. I don't know. All right. Any other questions? Was it over your head, ladies? I mean, did you get something out of it?
Could I say a little word about this? How much time do we have?
Oh, until the coffee bell rings. I'm delighted to have you here.
The wonderful thing about these interconnections, transmission interconnections, is that The rainfall, the snow, melts a little different in these mountains, and the time difference, the loads are different in Montana and Central. I'm with the city of Tacoma on their board, and I've been on that for 8 years, and 3 years on this Bonneville board, and I've sat in on quite a few of these things. Tacoma and Seattle in 1924, Seattle had its power plants up in this mountain, up Skagit. Tacoma at that time were in the, we had two plants here, but built 1928 and 30. And they built an interconnecting line because they found out that they have a lot of water sometimes in this mountain when we didn't have any. And so that was the start of the interconnection. And that, we just divided our water during the year. At the end of the year, we kept track. And we saved probably 100,000 kilowatts in power.
By interconnection?
Interconnection. Now, when they started interconnecting here, about 8 years ago, they figured they saved 600,000 kilowatts in power just by interconnection. And we have just finished a dam, Mayfield and Mossy Rock, two in a river called the Collis River that runs in Portland here. In May, we dedicated Mossy Rock, 350,000 kilowatts. And in that, the Federal Power Commission said we had to take care of the fish. So we have built the largest salmon hatchery in the world, 28,500,000 salmon eggs we raise, and we raise the salmon up to six to seven inches in a rearing pond before we turn them loose, and we have the largest trout hatchery in the world there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're welcome to go up there to see that. It's a beautiful sight. That dam cost us, we spent $15 million for the fish and $100 million for the dam at Mossy Rock, $52 million for the Mayfield Dam goes. We have six dams now. Then, these three dams here, Micah, Duncan, and Arrow Lake, they hold back 15 million acres of water, as much as all the dams now in the Columbia River. And the Columbia River always had its floods in May and June. Portland has been flooded out. Now, these dams will hold the water back so that May, June, July, August, September will have a uniform flow on the Columbia River. But those are summer months when we don't need it up here. California needs it down for irrigation and air conditioning. So that's one reason they want our power in the summertime. I made two trips to California, one to Arizona in selling power, because we would like to have sold our 300,000 kilowatts here that cost us 3.8 mils to California and then buy power from Bonneville, which is part of it, at about 2.1 mil. But it's worked out very nicely. So California, they have these two lines, like Ludwig said, two 500,000 volt AC lines, one going to San Francisco, one to Los Angeles, and they're building the two 750,000 volt DC lines, which will be, we won't need them. This will be 1973 when Micah's finished. Probably 72 now, I guess. They're pushing it very fast. These two are finished.
Yeah.
And so we've signed a contract with Northern California for 400,000 kilowatts. The contracts are 5 years. They have to have a contract with California for 5 years because it takes them that. They have to know whether they're going to have to build a steam plant down there, either a nuclear plant or a thermal plant of some kind. So we have, they're making contracts now for California, and they need them especially in the summertime. In the wintertime, we need the power. So it's a wonderful exchange of power.
Thank you so much, Henry.
Tacoma took 12.5% of this. As Ludwig said, the Canadian government, Mr. Pearson, and
Prime Minister,
and Johnson, they signed this contract, but no money. It cost about $330 million. So Tacoma took 12.5% of it. Seattle took 12.5% of it. The other plants took the rest of it. But we didn't have to put up any money on that 65. We put about $65 million. We have to guarantee $65 million, and Bonneville is handling this. The bond people, because we signed it, they were willing to handle the bonds, and Bonneville is handling the power as long as we don't need it and selling it to California, and then we will take it when we need it in a 5 year period.
I have to say one more word about future plans. Now this, we just talked about this interconnection, but this is not sufficient. There must be more generation. At some foreseeable time, the whole hydro capacity of the basin will be developed, and what then? That's the question which the Bonneville people and others has concerned to an ever-increasing degree. And the answer is, if all the hydro power is developed, then we have to have either steam power or atomic power, or possibly both. And at the moment, there is one conventional steam power, coal-fired steam power plant under construction near Chihuahua, which is somewhere here. This is under construction, right adjacent to a coal field, which is a not highest grade coal, but not lowest grade coal, medium grade coal. And it is interesting, and I didn't know that, that such steam power plant is tailor-made in its construction just for the coal which it burns. You see, if you have a higher grade coal, the technology of the plant is slightly different.
And in fact, it's right below Tacoma.
I should have.
They had these large.
Indicate Tacoma. Let's put in Tacoma. I don't want you to feel bad.
And these, but when they, these coal mines, but when they started to make diesel electric, they didn't need the coal, so they abandoned the mines. Now, we are taking 8% of that, that we're working on this now. We're taking $20 million in Tacoma. They've ordered already 3 700,000 kilowatt turbine generators. This will be coal fired. The plant is being built right on top of the coal mine.
Three?
Two of them, 2 700,000. Yeah. That's 1,400,000 kilowatt. The first plant, the Portland General Electric Company, Washington Water Power in Spokane, Portland General Electric, they are going to take the full outlet.
Yeah.
The next 700,000 kilowatts, Seattle, Tacoma, Puget Sound, Bar Light, and three other PDUDs are going to take the...
You see, it's all now one big happy family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once this is built, the next plants will very likely be atomic plants. And their location is still being a matter of debate and of very heated debate because suddenly people feel they are endangered, such plant may explode, which is great nonsense, because the atomic power plants have, from its very inception, been designed for ultra safety, because atomic energy is indeed something not likely to foot around with. The designers of atomic plants have taken every conceivable contingency into account, and the plants are designed with a safety factor which exceeds anything else you can think of. For that reason, I think an atomic plant may be even safer than an ordinary steam plant. After all, a boiler can blow up. It's very unlikely, you see. But that explosion in an atomic plant will obliterate a city nearby is totally out of the question. An atomic plant has been used to a great extent already in England. England has very definite problems with coal. They have run out of their coal. It will run out in a very short foreseeable time, more or less completely. And all the technological changes, all the miners getting out of their jobs, of course, I don't even want to touch on that. But the fact is that they have built atomic plants while we are still experimenting with different types of reactors. So when the water power is developed, then atomic plants will go into the picture, which by then have been fully standardized, I would say, and can produce energy competitively, even maybe cheaper than it is being done now. So this is not, it is not so that the thing will come to an end when the water power is developed. Unlike a coal field, which after, say, 30 years is mined out, and that's just the end. You can't do anything more. The water power is fully developed, and now you cannot go beyond that. You can build atomic plants, 1, 2, 3, and so on. These are all large plants. So
we have two plants. I come from the Midwest. Elk River and St. Croix. Building a third one, Prairie Island on the Mississippi, they find that there are two regulations with regard to pollution, the federal and the state. The federal is one thing, the state is another, and now the state is holding up the plant on the Mississippi because of pollution. And they have quite definite evidences there that even with the federal regulations of the pollution, that there is pollution of the waters in the streams, and that's what they're afraid about in the St. Croix too. Now, what have you found out here with regard to the building of the atomic plants and pollution? It seems like the outlet of the atomic plants creates enough heat within the water to kill the fish and the wildlife there.
Yeah, now I would not call that pollution, you see. It is true that, of course, a power plant an ordinary steam plant, you see the water which comes out from the condenser, if it is a large plant, will raise the temperature a little bit. Water won't boil, but I mean, fish is sensitive, and even if the water is raised a little bit. Now, these problems were discussed at great length when Hanford was built. It was did not get into the open, but of course, the building of the large atomic installations at Hanford, which are large factories producing fissionable material for war purposes, see, has raised the temperature of the Columbia, but not to such a degree that the fish life was endangered. You see, you can keep it under control. Is this true?
Yeah, that's correct. There's one, see, Hanford is right in here. We own 8% of Hanford. Is 200,000 kilowatts, and the pollution is temperature control. The fish people are the ones that are objecting, and they made such a big objection. Portland General Electric are building a 1 million kilowatt nuclear plant here. We are going to build 7 of them now. We're going to double our power. Over the next 10 years, we have to have 7. The first is started here. That's just Portland General Electric alone, but the next 2 are laid out, so we're all going to be dividing them. But the main trouble is the fish people claim that it will affect the salmon if we put the cooling water into the Columbia River. So Portland General Electric are putting cooling towers, the same as they do in England. The pollution is not, you don't get any radiation going into the water.
That's what I said. It's just
temperature.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of talk. They're afraid that one of these might blow up. They didn't want them near their cities. They're getting away from that. There's a lot of work being carried on right now on this Columbia River to determine whether or not, they said 2 degrees, that a 1 million kilowatt plant might increase the temperature 2 degrees at low water. But they found now there's going to be maybe 0.6 degrees. And we'll probably build a couple more here, but we'll build most of them right along the ocean where we won't have to worry. We have Snohomish in Seattle and laid one out in the Sound now. We're working with Puget Sound, Power and Light, City of Seattle, and Snohomish to build one right out here by Grays Harbor on the ocean. The trouble with these nuclear plants, the lead time is so long, it takes about 7 years. The first 3 years they do it's hardly any work, but it's in the turbines, the nuclear plants, the steam, it's not high pressure steam, it's mostly just about saturated, dry and saturated steam. So the turbines are very large, and only General Electric and Westinghouse were building them. Now Brown Bavaria is building 2 for TVA, these 500,000 kilowatt units, and both Westinghouse and General Electric are building big plants now to take care of it. So we're going to have 7 of them here, and when we get our 7 nuclear plants over the next 10 years, then they will be run as what we call base loads, and the hydro will be used for peaking. And that's why Cooley are putting in 3 600,000 kilowatt units now, with space for 3 more 600,000. As Ludwig said, it'll be over 5. It'll be the largest in the world. It'll be bigger than the one now. It'll be over 5.6 million. And we'll have an ideal situation then, as far because we do have the hydro, and they can hold the water back on these dams for peaking 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the night, or whatever we need.